Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report issued today on the economic impacts of climate change by the Risky Business Project that is a bipartisan coalition of financial leaders led by George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, hedge fund executive Tom Steyer, and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, along with President Nixon's and Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretaries George Shultz and Robert Rubin. Kate Gordon, the Executive Director of the Risky Business Initiative, joins us to discuss the increased awareness among business leaders of the severe impacts of rising sea levels and extreme heat from climate change and the growing need for businesses to integrate climate risks into their everyday decision-making. Then we will speak with Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen on Capitol Hill, about today's announcements by Senators Sheldon Whitehouse, Elizabeth Warren, Charles Schumer, and Richard Blumenthal that they are introducing a rebooted version of the Disclose Act that will shed light on the dark money pouring into elections following the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which has surged from $69 million in 2008 to $310 million in 2012. We'll discuss the new bill that will require any group that spends $10,000 or more to disclose who is behind the expenditures so that, as Senator Warren pointed out, those who are pouring money into elections at least have to be willing to stand up and admit that's what they are doing. Then finally, we'll go to Jackson, Mississippi, and speak with Robert McElvain, a professor of history at Millsaps College and author of Down and Out in the Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and the Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. We will discuss the results so far in today's bitter Republican primary election in Mississippi that has the longtime incumbent Senator Thad Cochran in a tight race with a Tea Party challenger in an election that has the GOP establishment on edge following the recent defeat of the House Majority Leader by an insurgent Tea Party candidate. And joining us now is Kate Gordon, who's the Vice President and Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Next Generation and the Executive Director of the Risky Business Initiative, a year-long effort to quantify and publicize the economic risks the United States faces from the impacts of changing climate. She is a nationally recognized expert on the intersection of clean energy and economic development and recently served as Vice President for Energy and Environment at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gordon.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
And Kate Gordon, it's always seemed likely to me, or at least perhaps even obvious in a way, that there are those companies that have an investment in climate denial, a rather short-sighted one, needless to say, but the Koch brothers with their refineries and pipelines and ExxonMobil, et cetera, you can understand that they are wanted to delay the inevitable as long as they can in order to sell their product. But on the other hand, surely the insurance companies and others have to be noticing that this is going to affect their bottom line.
Well, you know, we put Risky Business together. As you said, it's a very bipartisan effort, and we put it together in order really to get away from some of the partisan debate that's characterized the issue of climate change, particularly in the United States, and to make the point that, in fact, for any business, that's particularly businesses making long-term capital investments in particular places that are at risk, this has to be an issue that businesses take into account. And that, frankly, includes a lot of the energy businesses you were just talking about. Energy is one of the sectors that we explored, and the utilities and the energy businesses that have infrastructure or physical projects in some of these high-risk parts of the U.S. really are at risk. I mean, physical risk from climate change, whether it's rising sea levels or increased heat. So I think it needs to move beyond that ideological set of issues and really toward a just standard risk assessment part of anybody's business.
But the problem seems to have been, up until now at least, that the reality has been forestalled by this concerted effort to deny the reality. At what point do you think we'll get past that obstruction?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we really felt coming into the project that there had been a breakdown in the U.S. in talking about climate either along partisan lines when it came to the science or along partisan lines when it came to the specific policy solution. We really designed the project to get at the question of just a very standard business risk assessment. What are the risks and potential costs the U.S. faces from climate change if we stay on our current path? And I actually think that there is a number of businesses that in their everyday cycle, whether it's bond raters or, again, utilities, the agricultural sector, certain parts of the real estate and insurance sector, they are actually starting to think about these risks in a serious way, similar to how they think about extreme weather risks or, you know, other kind of catastrophic risks. I think we can get this conversation out of the political arena if it's very specifically about, you know, sort of what do businesses potentially face from a changing climate. It's just the same as asking the question about what are our potential risks from a 1-in-100-year flood? What are our potential risks from rising inflation, another very uncertain set of risks? So we just wanted to ground it in kind of traditional business speak and reach to businesses directly and get out of the political arena.
Well, surely, at least in terms of Wall Street, and you do have the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, who today talked about we can't afford to waste another minute because of rising sea levels that would make storms like Sandy look. He went on to say we have to plan for risks. Climate is one of them. I mean, Sandy literally was lapping at the feet of Wall Street, wasn't it? I mean, parts of Wall Street were flooded.
Yep, no, that's right. It's interesting. If there's one thing that I really took away from the research, which was done independently by a firm named Rhodium and independently peer-reviewed, if there's something I took away from it, it's that these risks are diverse across the United States and very local. So in a place like New York, you have rising sea levels, but more important, actually, you have this potential storm surge from increased hurricane activity combined with a ton of very valuable infrastructure sitting right on the water, as you just pointed out. But the thing is that those investors that are in those Wall Street buildings don't own those Wall Street buildings, and they're not the ones that necessarily put them in the ground. So it really underscores the need to not only look at the very specific region you're talking about, but also the very specific business interest you're talking about. Who is actually making those long-term bets on real estate and infrastructure? It's the municipal planners. Again, it's the bond raters and bond issuers. It isn't necessarily those investors in those buildings. Now, they may be making investments, however, in commodity agriculture, which has its own set of risks in a different part of the country. So we really want to just underscore from this report that you got to know your audience and who and what their specific focus is and what their specific interests are, that you can't come at this issue in a monolithic way.
Well, but in terms of food and as a basic commodity, your new report indicates that crop yields could fall by more than 70% in the Midwest.
Well, one thing we did in our report was we quantified not just the sort of averages or the median risks, but we also looked at what are called tail risks. So the 1 in 20, 1 in 100 scenarios. That's a pretty classic thing to do in a risk analysis. And it is true for agriculture that in some counties in particular in the Midwest and the South, you could see crop yield decline in those big commodity crops, corn, soy, wheat, cotton. You could see declines of up to about 70% in those tail risks. Now, in a more likely scenario, you could see declines in the sort of 20% range. It's important to note that the agricultural sector as a business sector has actually been pretty much on the front lines of this, and they've been calculating climate risk into their modeling forever. So they're adapting very quickly to changing climate conditions. Big companies like Cargill, represented by Greg Page, who was on our risk committee, are moving agriculture to different locations, are doing double and triple cropping, are doing a number of adaptive practices. But as Greg Page pointed out today, you can do that if you're a big company with a lot of different farms and suppliers in a lot of places. You can't necessarily do it if you're that farmer in southern Iowa who can no longer grow the crop that you've always grown. So it's a very local impact, again, and for somebody like, for a company like Cargill, it's all about their individual suppliers. They may be able to move the chain, but that still has an impact.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gordon, who's the Vice President and Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Next Generation and the Executive Director of the Risky Business Initiative, a year-long effort to quantify and publicize the economic risks the United States faces from the impacts of changing climate. She's a nationally recognized expert on the intersection of clean energy and economic development and recently served as Vice President for Energy and Environment at the Center for American Progress. But when you say that Cargill is adapting, It would seem to me that maybe we passed the point where we can prevent sea level rise and extreme heat, et cetera. I know people are talking about mitigating as opposed to preventing. So isn't it in everybody's interest, though, to really sound the alarm? Because the cost of mitigation and adaption it just becomes astronomic unless we do what we can to stop this process that is underway.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. I would really urge everybody sort of listening not to put too much of a separation between adaptation and mitigation. So adaptation is adapting to current reality, right? And mitigation is how do you prevent it from getting as bad as the report lays out. You know, we're dealing today, Hurricane Sandy is an example, of sea level rise that has already happened. That's already in place because of, in some cases, business decisions we made 50, 40 years ago. That sea level rise is in place. It led to increased storm surge and increased flooding in New York. We are not going to be able to reverse the tide, as it were, on those impacts, and we're going to have to adapt to them. Adapting to them will be expensive. Hurricane Sandy alone was a $66 billion storm. So we're going to have, we're going to see a lot of those expenses from adaptation, and we're going to have to deal with that. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that those future impacts, particularly the rising heat levels in the South and the Midwest parts of the country, those impacts can be avoided. The way we're going to have to avoid them is by taking action on mitigation today so that 40 or 50 years from now, we don't see those impacts baked into our system. So we do make a point in the report that just as businesses need to really start incorporating climate risk into their own decision-making, we urge the business sector to play a very active role with the public sector and public policymakers to really focus on mitigation, because we think that that's a critical part of the solution.
So I'm curious, though, Kate Gordon, about the psychological component here, because I get lots of mail from conservatives who insist that climate warming and global warming and climate change is a hoax. And after all, you know, the Science Committee in the House of Representatives is dominated by global warming deniers. The Prime Minister of Australia, which is one of the most impacted countries on the planet, there are parts now in the middle of Australia where the kangaroos cannot survive, where no human being can go out and stand out in the sun for very long. Yet he is a global warming denier. And much of what I read in terms of comments on these articles that are from the, 1% of global warming deniers that could, you know, in any way describe themselves in any way associated with the scientific community, there's a great sort of psychological need for people to really want to believe this. And I try to understand, has anybody done any research on what that mechanism is about, assuming that one could, you know, somehow defuse it?
No, that's a great question. There has actually been some really good social science research on the whole psychological kind of impact of denialism and what one does about it, and I cannot claim to be an expert on it at all. But I will say that this is just me speaking and in part working on this project. I will say that I have been very impressed in my career in climate and energy issues to the extent to which a job creating business in a district can change the mind of somebody who represents that district. So I do think that businesses have a very important role to play in talking to public policymakers. We have seen, for instance, Governor Kasich of Ohio, who was elected on a platform of getting rid of that state's renewable energy program, when he was elected, changed his mind because of Toledo businesses coming to him and saying, solar energy is actually an important job-creating business in Toledo. I think you can see that kind of change when policymakers have constituents that are businesses that are coming to them with very specific examples. So that's one area in which businesses have a role to play. I think another is by saying, look, you can't put us in a position where we are dealing with all of this uncertainty and all this risk. We are going to move. This is going to force us to move out of this region of the United States if nothing happens. And that's going to be a really big issue for places like the Southeast, where we've concentrated an enormous amount of energy and manufacturing infrastructure in the U.S. If the heat and humidity levels get to a point in the Southeast where energy costs are prohibitive and people can't work outside. So these are real business issues, real economic issues, and I've just seen in my career a lot of evidence that that can change even the most ideological point of view.
So where do you stand, Kate Gordon, in terms of Michael Bloomberg said today that there are about 700 leading U.S. companies, including General Motors, Nike, and Intel, who've publicly endorsed support for strong U.S. climate change policies, including Mindy Lubber, president of Cirrus.
And Cirrus has been, Mindy Lubber's company has been fantastic on this issue and done a lot of work convincing the insurance industry in particular to take a stand on climate change. The Risky Business Project does not take a specific stand on a policy, and I'll tell you the reason for that is that we found that starting with a policy suggestion or a policy prescription alienated half of our audience before we even started. We wanted to start with a very basic, very standard risk assessment that could bring a lot of people to the table who had not been there before, and to start a conversation about what these risks actually look like and what they might mean. I think that we have succeeded in broadening that conversation, and I think now what we'll do as a project is turn to that question of what those results mean.
Well, already, since you've signed up almost all of the recent secretaries of the Treasury, going back to President Nixon, and then I believe tomorrow, the current Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, along with former George W. Bush Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and the billionaire activist, climate activist Tom Steyer, they're meeting at the White House. And then I believe later, President Obama's having dinner with the going to the annual dinner of the League of Conservation Voters. So I detect a kind of political strategy here in terms of what the White House is trying to do. This issue keeps coming up time and time again. And, of course, the White House recently issued a very, very alarming report that nobody's been able to deny its authenticity and its impact.
And I should say that the National Climate Assessment, which the White House, actually, it wasn't the White House that put it out. They amplified it. It was done by a very independent group of about 300 scientists. That report, we built on that report in our report. We used a lot of the same climate modeling, so definitely an impressive effort. You know, we all from the beginning have felt that this was an effort aimed at the business community and that there were private sector and public sector responses to these climate risks. So we launched the project in New York, and then we're spending a day in D.C. having a number of private meetings, and I think it just underscores the need to have this conversation happen both within the private sector and the public sector, because as you pointed out earlier, there are very critical responses in terms of adaptation and resilience and incorporating climate risk into business decisions. Those kinds of responses have to also happen within the public sector, from public sector decision makers and investors, and also we have to have a conversation about policy. So we are playing on all those fields and really looking forward to seeing how people engage with the report.
Well, just in closing, in terms of policy, of course, I mentioned the Australian Prime Minister. He's now trying to undo the world's only, carbon tax.
Yeah.
But Hank Paulson has suggested that a carbon tax is one way of putting a price on pollution, one way of letting the market operate. Now, that seems unlikely in our house, at least. It doesn't seem to have a snowball's chance. But I noticed that Secretary Rubin suggested, in terms of executive action, that an interim step that doesn't need congressional approval would be requiring the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Accounting Standards Board to disclose the risks that climate change poses to their assets and profits. So just explain how that would impact the business world.
Well, you know, I think that that first of all, the fact that, Secretaries Paulson and Rubin had very different responses to the solution is actually great. I mean, we've always thought a strength of this project was that the folks on it come from very different places and have very different ideas of the solution, but agree on the problem. And so we have not, as I said, taken one policy kind of position as a risky business project. In terms of what Secretary Rubin was talking about, he's really saying, look, if it's critical to how businesses incorporate climate risk into their decision-making, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, should make that something that they have to do. So it may be that those risks are small. There are companies for whom those risks will not be particularly big, where they don't have physical infrastructure, or they're extremely, you know, nimble, or they're able to adapt very easily. There is that set of companies. But for some companies, particularly ones we've highlighted in energy, infrastructure, and agriculture, those risks may be big. And so Secretary Rubin was basically saying, look, companies should have to disclose those risks so that shareholders and investors can react with full information. And I think that's really what he was getting across, is that disclosure can be a very good way to start to move the needle on consumer response, shareholder response, investor response, and that is an important part of the business cycle and the business sort of incorporation of climate change into its DNA, if you will.
Well, Kate Gordon, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. This was great.
Again, I've been speaking with Kate Gordon, who's the Vice President and Director of the Climate and Energy Program at Next Generation and the Executive Director of the Risky Business Initiative, a year-long effort to quantify and publicize the economic risks the United States faces from the impacts of a changing climate. She's a nationally recognized expert on the intersection of clean energy and economic development and recently served as Vice President for Energy and Environment at the Center for American Progress. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the new rebooted Disclose Act.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. Previously, he was Senior Policy Analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Holman.
Glad to be here, Ian.
And today, in a Senate chamber, the New Disclose Act was announced by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Elizabeth Warren, and Senator Blumenthal. So, first of all, of course, there's a companion bill in the House. That doesn't have a prayer, does it, given the Republican control of the House? But what can this Disclose Act achieve, do you think, given that the last attempt, shortly after Citizens United, the decision came down from the Supreme Court? The first Disclose Act got absolutely nowhere. It was shot down by the Republicans. So what do you think the fate of this new Disclose Act will be?
Well, to clarify, the first Disclose Act covered a lot more than just transparency and disclosure issues. And so that raised a lot of controversy and made it impossible to get through. This version of the Disclose Act is a straightforward, simple transparency measure. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy to get through in the Senate, but the underlying purpose of this is to get a public dialogue going both within the halls of Congress and hopefully among voters as we go into the 2014 elections as to what exactly is going wrong with our campaign finance system and how to address it and who is going to address it. That's the key issue here. The Disclose Act, I certainly hope it does pass the Senate, but, you know, I'm not going to count on it. What I'm counting on is that this is going to contribute to a massive public dialogue over the abuse of money in politics that is now just entirely unregulated.
So the fact that a number of Republican senators used to support disclosure, including, I think, Mitch McConnell, Senator Jeff Sessions, Susan Collins, and John Cornyn of Texas, they were even supporting it up until about 2010. What happened to the Republicans? It seems as though Citizens United, in many ways, was a political decision on the part of the conservatives on the Supreme Court to allow the Republicans the advantage of unlimited money. At the same time, the decisions on voting rights have allowed them to suppress the vote. So to me, this looks as if this is a Republican strategy to perhaps get over their demographic problem. So at the end of the day, given the fact that what few Republicans supported disclosure no longer support it, is this clearly a case where you're just simply never going to get Republican support?
I would not go that far. However, your analysis, I think, is spot on. You know, there are many Republican senators that I work closely with in trying to get the McCain-Feingold law through, and we succeeded with the help of people like Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe and John McCain and other Republican senators that you just discussed. What happened to change their minds in 2010 was Citizens United. Citizens United, five justices on the Supreme Court, as you all know, open up the floodgates to corporate and other special interest money into our elections, much of which goes undisclosed. And as it has poured in, this anonymous secret money, we know where it's being spent. We just don't know where it's coming from. And where it is being spent is about 4-1 in favor of Republican candidates as opposed to Democratic candidates. And with that, it was Mitch McConnell that really whipped the Republicans in the Senate in line and got them all to march in lockstep to oppose disclosure. Because as long as you and I and the American public don't know where all this money is coming from, the Republicans see it as being to their advantage in the elections. Now, I'm really hoping this is going to change. I mean, Americans are getting sick and tired of all this anonymous secret money flowing into elections. And I'm hoping with this discussion of another very simple, straightforward transparency measure, if Republicans oppose it and Democrats favor it, I hope we hear from voters come 2014. And if that's the case, then hopefully afterwards we can start pressing Republicans into sticking to their principles that they used to.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Holman, who's a government affairs legislative representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. Previously, he was senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. But even in the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, it allowed for disclosure. So the Disclose Act is not at odds with the Citizens United decision. Is that in any way getting through, or is it just purely cynical politics where the Republicans are being handed a gift by the Supreme Court and they're going to take advantage of it?
Well, that is one of the real ironies of this whole partisan debate in Congress, is the Supreme Court opened up the floodgates to corporate money into our elections, but then they made it very clear that we don't have to worry about it because we have such an excellent disclosure system that everyone's going to know where this money is coming from, and they can judge the merits of campaign finance campaign ads based upon that knowledge. well, you know, this money, all this new money, especially if it's coming from businesses that have, you know, requests before Congress, especially, you know, before, you know, various committees run by Republican leaders, you know, it isn't going to fare that well for the Republicans if us, the public, actually knows who is trying to influence their votes. And so it's been purely at the congressional level where disclosure has been prevented. You know, just to even highlight the fact that the court is with us on transparency, even in the last disastrous campaign finance decision, McCutcheon versus FEC, the same court said once again, but we have an excellent system for disclosure. We have the internet, so everyone can know where all this money is coming from, so don't fear. Well, you know, we keep going back to Congress with this message of saying, you know, at least have transparency of money in politics. And it didn't succeed in the last session, but let's see if it carries some greater weight this time around.
But Craig Holman, are the Supreme Court justices, the five conservatives who voted for the Citizens United decision, are they an alternative universe? They must know that whatever they were thinking about disclosure was just a dream, a wish list. It didn't happen. Aren't they aware of the 501c4, so-called social welfare tax-exempt umbrellas that prevent the disclosure allow for the anonymity of unlimited amounts of money coming from plutocrats and from corporate heads? I understand the reason why a head of a corporation, particularly a publicly traded corporation that sells consumer goods, would not want to have their name associated with a political party because they might lose half of their customers, whether half is Democrat or half are Republicans. But that's the whole point of disclosure, is to discourage people from taking these partisan positions at the risk of their own, you know, offending consumers. So there's a built-in discipline, if you will. But as long as you don't disclose it, then people can basically, an individual, a head of a company, can decide, because he's a Republican, he can just pour unlimited amounts of the corporation's treasury into politics without the public being any the wiser. So that's what I don't understand, is do the justices know that in spite of the fact that they say that we have the best system of disclosure in the world with the internet, that it just isn't happening? I mean, there's the disconnect.
I believe those five justices were truly naive about our disclosure system in 2010 with the Citizens United decision. When you read that decision, you know, read it over and over, you see, you know, Justice Kennedy writing about how we have an excellent disclosure system and all this money is going to be known. And, you know, they say it over and over. I mean, truly naive. We've got to keep in mind that this is the first U.S. Supreme Court in American history that has no justice on it who's ever run for public office. So campaign fundraising is totally, totally foreign to them. They haven't got a clue what it's about or its potential for corruption. However, when we came to the last decision in McCutcheon, there's just no way they could not know the unintended consequence of the loss of disclosure that their Citizens United decision resulted in. You know, America has been hammering and discussing and arguing and pointing out all the numbers of the lack of disclosure. We literally went from almost 100% donor disclosure in 2004 and 2006 down to 50% in 2010. And in 2012, we had more than $300 million in dark money being spent in our elections. And if those justices just simply read newspapers, they've got to know this. So I believe they were truly naive in the beginning. They just don't want to recognize the unintended consequence of their decision.
Well, Craig Holman, you may well be being generous if you say they were naive the first time around, but the second time around with McCutcheon, they have to know it, and they're not doing anything about it. So it gets back to my assumption that these justices are, in effect, political operatives. They are really trying to give their party, the Republicans, an advantage. And it's manifest, it's apparent, it's real, and it's ongoing. And I guess a Disclose Act is the only way you're going to stop that, right? And that's where we're back to, right? The announcement today by these three senators, Sheldon Whitehouse, Elizabeth Warren, and Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut.
Well, the Disclose Act is the least we can do. It is very significant to try to get transparency of all this new money flowing into our elections. But quite frankly, it doesn't cure the problem. It's not a fix-all. It's just an appropriate and necessary step that has to be made. The real problem with these five justices is, you know, they're not just conservative. I mean, the Rehnquist Court was conservative, and they upheld all the campaign finance and disclosure requirements. This new Roberts Court is not just conservative. They really are corporatists, and they really do want to unleash corporations in all walks of our life, including our democracy. And that's what they are working towards. I think they do recognize there can be no reasonable argument against transparency of money in politics. They just want to unleash corporations so that they can dominate our government. That's the situation we're stuck with. The Disclose Act, as a simple, straightforward transparency measure, goes a long ways toward helping fix some of the problems. But if we're really going to fix the damage that has been done to our democracy by Citizens United and McCutcheon, we've got to start seriously considering a constitutional amendment to clarify to this court what the First Amendment really means.
Well, that is underway with Senator Udall's bill, right? But it's a heavy lift because you have to get two-thirds of the legislators with three-quarters of the vote, don't you?
We're going a long ways on Udall's constitutional amendment, and for that matter, all of them. You know, we've been working hard to try to make this into a very, very real campaign, and we are getting there. It used to be just a grassroots campaign where we were going out to the public because 80% of Americans are just shocked by Citizens United and, you know, want to see it reverse. You know, it's been trying to get the feeling and sentiment of the American public felt here on Capitol Hill in Congress, and it's finally beginning to happen. The Senate is taking the constitutional amendment drive very, very seriously. They have scheduled already committee votes and markups, and Harry Reid is going to take it to the floor of the Senate in September to get the Senate voting on it. So we've moved this campaign, constitutional amendment campaign, from the grassroots into the institutions of Congress. It's starting to gel. And you know something else, Ian? I just to talk a little bit about the constitutional amendment, there were 15 of these amendments introduced in the 113th Congress. And we weren't going to go anywhere if everyone's fighting over the wording of the constitutional amendment. Well, Udall started working with other congressional leadership in the House, other sponsors of constitutional amendments, and it appears as if they've been able to hammer out one single unified language. So we're going to have one dominant constitutional amendment. The push is going to get easier now.
Well, you mentioned the Supreme Court, at least the conservative majority, being corporatist. I mean, they just came up with an extraordinary corporatist ruling against the government of Argentina, where 92% of the creditors had agreed to take a haircut and get repaid pennies on the dollars. But the vulture funds, who held out for the full payment, representing only 8% of the creditors, were handed a gift by the Supreme Court that has very detrimental international repercussions for poor countries. So they really showed their hand there. But what I find extraordinary about the Republicans, and equally puzzled about how the Democrats can't somehow call them out on this, is that while Citizens United has given this extraordinary advantage, of which they're certainly taking advantage of it, they also at the same time are hammering away at this phony IRS scandal. Darrell Issa hauled the IRS commissioner in to give a very theatrical dressing down with all of his sort of bullying tactics. And clearly what they're trying to do with that, because there's no there there, just as there's no there there in the Benghazi theatrics that they're also engaged in, that what they're trying to do is basically intimidate the IRS into never, ever looking into these 501c4s.
And don't forget the Securities and Exchange Commission as well, which has a petition pending before it to require publicly owned corporations to disclose their political spending as well. The Republicans in Congress started attacking the SEC for even considering that petition. However, you know, these are several battles that are being fought here on Capitol Hill, and they've been a stalemate from 2010 to 2012. But we're entering a new period here. I mean, just from the work in Congress, we're going to start seeing discussions in the national agenda on the Disclose Act, on the Real Transparency Time Act, the constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United. The Supreme Court keeps coming out with new whacking decisions that just shocks America, McCutcheon being the last one, and that's generating further public discussion. We're moving this whole debate away from these little battles involving the IRS or the SEC or even the House of Representatives or the Senate into a national debate. And so I think we're going to start seeing some resolutions of these issues soon.
Well, Craig Holman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Holman, who's the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. Previously, he was Senior Policy Analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and go to Jackson, Mississippi for an update on the bitter primary battle underway. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Jackson, Mississippi, is Robert McElvain, a professor of history at Millsaps College, whose books include The Great Depression, America 1929 to 1941, Down and Out in the Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and The Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McElvain.
Glad to be with you.
And do you have any results yet? The polls closed about 40 minutes ago in Mississippi.
Well, at the moment, they're totally meaningless, I would say. It looks like 440-some for McDaniel to 220-some for Cochran, but it's just a tiny smattering of votes. Nothing to be read in it yet.
But my understanding is that Cochran's fate, basically, is only about 150,000 people are going to vote. Is that right?
That's probably right, yes.
And what would the out of how many potential voters?
I'm not really sure what the total number of potential voters is. Probably though, no more than 10% that will actually be voting.
So, but there's an awful lot of outside money being poured in, right?
Oh, huge amounts on both sides. It's really a contest. To try to determine whether I would put it that the Republican Party, at least in the state, and to some extent nationally, is going to continue to be a conservative party or is going to be something far more radical to the right. I don't really understand why genuine conservatives don't rebel against these people on the extreme right calling themselves conservatives. I've long argued they should be called something like regressives as the opposite of progressives.
But obviously the Republican establishment is still reeling from the upset defeat of the House Majority Leader by a Tea Party insurgent.
Absolutely. Of course, that was also a very small turnout in that race. And in that case, Cantor was so confident of victory, he wasn't even in his district on the day. But Cochran, if he wasn't scared before the original primary on June 3rd, he's certainly been scared since then and has been campaigning very hard.
And this is what I find extraordinary about this reddest, one of the reddest of the red states, Mississippi, Robert McElveen, is that in effect the blue states in this country subsidize a lot of these red states, including Mississippi, where they get far more back from the U.S. Treasury than they give to the Treasury in terms of tax dollars. And yet, and of course, the long tenure of Senator Thad Cochran is one of just ladling out the pork. And yet the guy that's running against him, who might well defeat him, is against pork barrel politics, and he's actually isn't he running against him on the basis that this guy has provided too many projects, too much money, too many goodies to the state? Isn't that somewhat surreal?
Very hard to understand from any sort of a rational viewpoint. Yes, you're right. Mississippi, something just under 46% of the Mississippi state budget comes from the federal government. Mississippi and New Mexico sometimes go back and forth between which state gets the highest return for every dollar that they send to Washington. Mississippi gets back almost $2 for every dollar it sends to Washington. The one thing that McDaniel is doing is at least being consistent, because Republicans, particularly here, for years and years are always railing against the federal government and federal spending. But then every time they run on the basis of how much money they're bringing in from Washington. I remember one race that Trent Lott had back in the 90s, and I looked at all of his like five main commercials, and he was basically taking a liberal position in every one of them while he was denouncing liberals. So it's a strange way things go here. I think there's really a long history of this, though, of people in the South in general, and anything that applies in the South in general, you can raise to at least the third power in Mississippi. You can go all the way back to the Civil War, when so many people who were not slaveholders were out dying to protect the property of slaveholders. And ever since, they have continued basically to vote against their own interests. The Tea Party now is favoring things that help huge corporations and billionaires and goes against their own interests, but they're out there doing it.
Well, you know, that's what this is. The Confederacy and the Civil War, the army seemed to be all about. All of those working class, poor white Southern guys, farmers and blacksmiths, were fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. They keep reenacting it and keep, memorializing this great tragedy. But there's this cognitive dissonance about the real underlying economics of...
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I saw today a couple of McDaniel supporters who were themselves on various public assistance and talking about, well, yes, I'm on that, but we've got to cut out all this federal spending. They don't seem to have any realization of what it means for them. Another example... This state, even the mainstream Republicans, have refused to take the expansion of Medicaid, totally paid for by the federal government, and then in a few years, 90% paid for. And it would not only would help all sorts of people in need, and we're talking here about the working poor, the really poor, non-working poor, already on Medicaid, not only would it help them and be what some people here might say is the Christian thing to do, but it would bring all this money into the state, it would be recirculated, it would be great for the whole state, but they don't want to do it because it would help these poor people, and they see poor people as mainly black people, and they just don't want to do it.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert McElveen, Professor of History at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. His books include Down and Out, The Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and The Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. My understanding is that Cochrane, in this runoff election, since he didn't get over the 50% mark in the recent primary, that he's signaled to the African American community, who universally vote Democrat, just as the whites in Mississippi vote Republican. I mean, it's the statistics are quite stark.
Matter of fact, I'll address that point in a minute, but a story that illustrates that, my wife and I, who are white Democrats, when we went to vote in the primary 3 weeks ago, went to the Democratic table, and the African-American women there were sort of pounding and pointing on the table, no, this is the Democratic primary. They figured if we were white, we couldn't possibly be voting Democratic. Cochran has, if he does manage to eke it out today, it will be because of an appeal for African American, normally Democratic voters to protect him, to keep McDaniel from coming in, and how dangerous he is to them.
Well, but I don't understand how it works. First of all, you've got all these poll watchers that they put out. And it's pretty clear who's a Democrat, because they'll be African American. Their skin will be black.
Right.
So you got these white poll watchers, and apparently Democrats can vote if they didn't vote in the primary for a Democrat, and they've also can't vote in the general if they vote for Cochran. I don't know how you'd ever police that.
Not that they can't. There's some law that dates back to the early 1940s that says you should not be allowed to vote in a primary unless you intend at that point to vote for that party's candidate in the general election. But it's totally unenforceable.
That's what I wondered about, yeah. So did you have any, is there any local reporting? Have you seen any evidence of a lot of African Americans showing up to vote for Cochran?
Yes, well, I mean, you of course don't know for sure who they're voting for, but almost certainly they would be voting for Cochran. There have been several African-American precincts I've seen video of with not long lines, but with lines of people voting, and normally you would, if it was just a Republican runoff, you wouldn't see anybody showing up in these almost entirely African-American precincts. So I think that gives Cochran some hope. As of a week or so ago, he was pretty much written off on the assumption that the people who would come out to vote in a runoff would be principally the really strongly motivated people who are Tea Party supporters.
Well, so I don't understand, though, why voters, even Tea Party voters, weren't a little turned off by some of McDaniel's tactics, sending a film crew in to photograph Cochran's bedridden wife, who's been locked away in a home for, decades, I think. And then the bizarre business of a bunch of McDaniel's aides being locked into I think it was the courthouse where the votes are being counted in the last primary.
That's right. They went in. They originally claimed that they had been allowed in by a uniformed guard, and that turned out to be totally untrue. Somebody all of the Watergate break-in had apparently somehow propped a door open or taped over the lock on the door so they could get themselves back in. They never, to the best of my knowledge, have given any reason why they were there. The vote counting had stopped, and the only possible reason you would go in is to try to somehow tamper with the votes, which they were not able to do because they were locked up. And then they had to couldn't get back out and had to call the police in order to let them out.
So they're the gang that couldn't shoot straight, right? Not only are they doing stuff that's extremely dubious and fairly criminal and extremely undemocratic, they're incredibly incompetent at what they're doing. They make the Watergate guys look like professionals.
I wouldn't go that far, but they're in a similar vein, at least.
Yeah, but my question to you, Robert McElveen, was: has this in any way, in the local press, has it ever, you know, dampened the enthusiasm for this candidate?
Well, I mean, local press and television a great deal, but most of the people, you have to understand that so many of these people who are Tea Party supporters, not just in Mississippi but across the country, are basically people who pay no attention to facts. They live in a universe where they just believe what they want to believe. And so even after it came out, for instance, that break-in at the county courthouse, that in fact they had not been allowed in by uniformed officers as they claimed they had, people were still just writing, you know, on blogs and on comments on newspaper websites and things about how, oh, they were just let in by them. They pay no attention to the facts. And so, yeah, it hurt them with some people. But what will be interesting if McDaniel does win is to see whether the mainstream Republicans will support him or not. I guess certainly he would be the favorite against former Congressman Travis Childers, who's the Democratic nominee. But I think that Childers might have an outside chance of winning simply because so many of the Cochran supporters have come to absolutely despise McDaniel. And even if they can't bring themselves to vote for a Democrat, they may just not vote in the Senate race.
And is there any possibility of a third candidate splitting the vote to help the Democrat?
No, if I'm not mistaken, I think the time for a third candidate to file is over.
I see. Well, at this point, the latest that we're seeing here in terms of results in this bitterly contested Republican primary in Mississippi for the U.S. Senate is 8% of the vote reporting Cochran at 58.4 and McDaniel at 41.6. And as you know, obviously that's meaningless because it depends upon which counties these votes come from, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, among the things that Cochran and his supporters were doing since the first primary is, for instance, going to places like Pascagoula, where there's the huge shipyard that has all sorts of federal contracts, and getting the union people there to realize that they might well be losing their jobs if this guy gets elected. Not only should he get elected and the Republicans take control of the Senate, if Cochran were still there, he would be the head of the Appropriations Committee, but it would go to a senator from Alabama instead, who would undoubtedly be shifting those things to Alabama as soon as he could. So I think some people have awakened to how devastating it might be if Cochran loses.
And yet they call Obama a socialist, right? And when when this Thad Cochran is running as a socialist.
Yes, you know, anybody who's to the right of Ayn Rand is a socialist to some of these people.
No, but I mean,
to the left, rather.
But this is pure socialism, isn't it? These are government.
Of course it is.
Government contracts, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And heavens forbid that we lose them to Alabama. Well, Robert McElveen, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McElveen, who's a professor of history at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. His books include The Great Depression, America, 1929 to 1941, Down and Out in the Great Depression, Letters from the Forgotten Man, and the Encyclopedia of the Great Depression. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.